these chapters in the book of Acts, one chapter each Sunday. And by the way, I want to announce that next Sunday, Dr. Oates has agreed to teach. I know we'll want to have a good turnout for Dr. Oates. I'm awful glad he's able to do it. Our lesson this morning is from the third chapter of the book of Acts. And the subject of it is, what do you have to share? Of course, the story of Peter and John going up to the temple and finding the lame man who had been lame from his mother's womb, and he was restored to health. Now Peter and John went up together into the temple, the hour of prayer being the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I believe. And a certain man, lame from his mother's womb, was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple, who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked an alms. And Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, "Look on us." And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. And then Peter said, "Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have, give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. I think that reference to feet and ankle bones is one little straw that indicates that Luke was a physician. He didn't just say he was able to walk. His feet and ankle bones received strength. And as the lame man, which was healed, held Peter and John, all the people ran together unto them in the porch that is called Solomon, greatly wondering. And when Peter saw it, he answered unto the people, "Ye men of Israel, why marvel ye at this? Or why look ye so earnestly on us, as though by our own power or holiness we had made this man to walk? The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the God of our fathers hath glorified his son Jesus, whom ye delivered up and denied him in the presence of Pilate, when he was determined to let him go. And ye denied the Holy One and the Just, and desired a murderer to be granted unto you, and killed the Prince of Life, whom God has raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses. And his name, through faith in his name, hath made this man strong, whom ye see and know. Yea, the faith which is by him hath given him this perfect soundness in the presence of you all." That ends with a couple of words. There's been a lot written about here, but the Bible sort of gives a little approval to the expression of "you all," as in the presence of you all. Now, that great story, which is a very familiar one in the Bible, is a most graphic story. Here's Peter and John going up to the temple, and they find this man whom they always brought left there so he could get on. Great crowds went to the temple to pray. There were three times in the day, as I understand, when the crowds went into the temple to pray. You may observe, this is, I believe, one of the Jewish holidays right now, started Friday night. And the people go and they congregate in the synagogue. Well, they went three times. They went early in the morning, and the ninth hour, which is 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they went at sunset. So three times a day they went to the temple to pray. It's like that soft drink when you're supposed to take a 10, 2, and 4, because they had regularity with their prayer. And the Jews were a generous people to their own people at any rate, and they still are. It's remarkable. Back in the times when they're having so much trouble under Hitler, and some of those people managed to get loose and get over to this country, and I talked to a Jewish friend of mine. I said, how in the world did you arrange it? Well, he said, we had arranged a fund up in Chicago somewhere that we took care of. Took care of their own. I think it's a marvelous thing that they've done that generally. They have been a generous nation, at least to their own people. And this beautiful gate where they left this man was apparently a place which would attract the crowds. He wanted to get where he could see the people and get alms. He didn't go to temple worship. He went for alms. I understand that someplace there, from one of the courts to another, from the court of the Gentiles, court of women or something of the kind, and Josephus said of it that the bronze doors were beautiful and exceeded in value, gates plated with silver and set in gold. So it was a very remarkable place and a wonderful place for a beggar to go, where people would see him. Now Luke, in writing this story, apparently wrote it for the Romans. Theophilus may have been, we don't know, may have been a Roman official. At any rate, you notice in Peter's sermon, which of course is summarized here, when he got up and preached, made the speech to the people, he didn't say the Romans crucified Christ. They did, strictly speaking, take him out to Roman soldiers. He says, you did. You were the ones before Pilate. Pilate wanted to release him. And you insisted that he should release him to you, Barabbas. And he puts all the blame on the Jews who were right there in his hearing. Peter was the spokesman. Now, Peter and John were along. It doesn't say much about John. I believe in the book of Acts, Peter and John are linked together in these incidents about six different times. Some people have thought because John seemed to be so inactive in this, that maybe this was John Mark, Peter's interpreter, who wrote, you might say, Peter's gospel, the Gospel of Mark. Maybe this was John Mark, which nobody knows. But we generally assume it was the Apostle John. Peter was outspoken, and John was. Peter, apparently, in this early church, was the first leader of the church. And then he was a little later on succeeded by James, the brother of Jesus. How they selected the leader isn't made plain. Luke doesn't go into that. Maybe it isn't very important. It would be interesting to know, but I don't know if nobody knows. Luke has a style of writing and a manner of telling the story in such a way as to convey to the reader that there can be no doubt about the truth of what he was saying. You see, he points out, this cure of this man was attested by popular approval. They were there in thought. And then when Peter made his speech, he says, of which we were witnesses. We know what we're talking about. It isn't hearsay. And then there was a tacit admission by the Sanhedrin that they're worried. Not worried because they said they had healed a man, but because they had healed a man. So you say Luke has that great facility of telling a story and making it manifestly a true story. I thought this story divided, this chapter divides itself up into three different topics. One's the don't are, and one is the don't need, and the third is the gift. Those are the three things to talk about. The giver, and those who receive, and the thing given. You know, the divine always works through the human. God works through people. Peter did not have silver and gold. Lots of things Peter did not have. And he began to emphasize he didn't have silver and gold. That's what the man asked him for, was silver and gold. He didn't have education. He might have said, I do not have any social position, because he certainly didn't have. He didn't have moral steadiness. But to know that the world's more interested in what people do, what they have, than what they do not have. A great Moody, the great evangelist. If he goes a little back of our time, I don't suppose anybody ever heard Moody. I had the privilege one time of sitting next to Moody's son at a dinner. But Moody certainly was one of the great preachers. And he preached a sermon one time, and somebody went to Master and said, "You made 6 grammatical mistakes." Well, he said, very likely I did. But such as I had, I gave. Maybe he didn't have the education some ministers had, but he had something. And he gave what he had. The widow's mite, in the case of the widow who gave what she had. God never gave one a talent to keep, but only a talent to use. Story is told about Rudyard Kipling and and William Booth. Were both given honorary doctor's degrees at Oxford on the same occasion. 2 very different men, of course. And you know, they're very formal about that matter of giving honorary degrees at Oxford. I saw them do it one time. They won't grant them in absentia. That's one of the old rules of Oxford. You can't grant an honorary degree unless the recipient is there to get it. But during the beginning of the war, my son was a graduate up at Harvard College, and Harvard wanted to grant an honorary degree to President Roosevelt. But Roosevelt couldn't go to England to receive it. That was out of the question. And so in the way the English figure things out, they rented a spot on the campus of Harvard University. So that was Oxford for the time being. And Lord Halifax came over to confer the degree on Roosevelt, and because that was going to be a part of Oxford, it wouldn't be an absentee. Well, Lord Halifax got up there, and it turned out Roosevelt couldn't get there that day, so they granted an absentee after all. But he made a lot of fun out of it, and he said, "You know, it's a strange thing to have a little bit of Oxford here in Cambridge." And he was just very funny, I thought. Very serious, though. He was the chancellor of Oxford University. Well, when Rudyard Kipling and Booth came up to get their degrees together on this occasion, Booth went over to Kipling and he said, "Young fellow, how's your soul?" And he approached him right there. Well, Booth was another one of those that gave what he had. You know, Josiah Royce, the great psychologist, had a definition of faith one time. He says, "The soul's insight or discovery of some reality that enables man to stand anything that can happen to him in the universe." We don't go to church to be comforted. Go to church to be warned, to be rebuked, to learn. This man came to church to receive alms. Of course, in his distress, you could excuse him for that. But we don't go to church to get money. And of course, in this lesson, there's the story of the great area of need for medical missionaries. Who would ever think there's any question about the fact that missionaries can accomplish a great deal when they go out and they're able to minister unto the physical needs of people in great distress. Medical missionaries. I heard some stories about Arthur Grafton. They tell me about his father over in China. Some of the remarkable things that happened over in his missionary headquarters while he was there. What part does Christian religion have to do with the battle against disease? There are varying opinions about it. Now there are some people, notably the Christian Science, they think it has everything to do. That's the only. Healing comes through faith alone. And then there are those who dispute that and go the other extreme and say it has nothing to do. And then there's the third, who couple the two together as Peter did in this very lesson. I think myself a certain amount of truth to the belief in Christian science. There is substitution. There is an effect of mind over body. Of course there is. The only thing I object to is making a religion out of a thing that's a scientific fact, and thereby perhaps excluding other things which are also of great importance. You know, when John the Baptist sent emissaries to Jesus to ask whether he was the real one, what did he say? He said, "You go and tell John, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf can hear, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." See, he couples it all together. That's what it is. Who gives himself with his alms feeds three, himself, his hungering neighbor, and me. I think that's the thought. The man had a breakdown in his car, and somebody came along and had a rope in his car, and he tied the two together and he towed him along for 15 miles. And the man who was towed along said to him, "What can I do for you?" And he said, "Well, you don't have to do anything. I did this because I wanted to help you." "You can't do that." And he says, "Tell you how you can show your gratitude. Get you a rope and carry it in your car. So when somebody else comes along, you can help them." If you've ever had that experience, you know that's a great comfort to have somebody appear right there with a rope or a wire chain of some kind to help you. I read some statistics about people of great incomes in this state. I think they said there were over 700 in the state of Kentucky, according to the income tax return. Of course, you know that's a little bit deceptive because a lot of people have non-taxable incomes. Over 700 had incomes over $50,000 a year in the state of Kentucky. In a way, I was a little surprised as small as that, but yet, if you take it on a percentage basis, maybe that's not so surprising after all. The slogan that we have in this present campaign for the community test, you know, these lessons have a remarkable way of being very timely. Together we live, together we give. And so, it's not the gift without the giver. So I think the don't all is an important part of this lesson. And then another important thing is the don't eat. He was a beggar outside the church. What did a beggar go to church for? Why did he go outside the church? You wouldn't expect to find a lot of rich people going to church, would you? Find them elsewhere. More than you would a church, I would think. It's significant. He didn't go outside a nightclub or a movie or a racetrack. He went to church. He knew he would find the people there. He'd be more inclined to want to help. And you see it. Yesterday, people in distress go to church. They don't go to other places such as I mentioned. One of the most interesting things to me is Pershing Square out in Los Angeles. I love to go around that place. You never learn anything except as you observe the different kinds of people. Some of them talk communism. Some of them talk atheism. They'll prove it by the Bible. And they talk divine healing. I saw a man, this is one of the meanest things I ever saw. He went up to some of these divine healers. He said, "I've got a terrible headache. What can you do for him?" They tried to say words and help him, and he said, "It's not any better." He was just tormenting him. But all around that place at Pershing Square is the greatest collection of crackpots, I think, in the United States. That's an interesting place, but the beggar wouldn't go there for help. No, he'd go to church. Sometimes the donee of the alms is not a very much of a thinking person. Sometimes you're trying to help people who are not able to appreciate altogether what you do for them. If they weren't that way, maybe they wouldn't all be needing alms. This little boy in school, he has said to one of his little friends, wanted to get a toy, and the friend wouldn't give it to him and says, "You know, the Bible says to share. And if you don't share, I'm going to hit you in the head. So you have to deal with people sometimes that you think they're not as appreciative as they should be. But with providential care. Providential care, so much can be accomplished, so much can be done. There was a ship that sunk in the harbor. It was just down in the mud. And they sent divers down, and they got some tugs, and they pulled and pulled, and they couldn't pull it loose. And a little boy came along, and he said, "I'll tell you how to do it. You take some big barges out there, right above it, and you tie these ropes to those barges. And now go on home and wait. And the tide will come in, and the Lord will raise that ship." And it came up, and they brought it up to the surface. You see, you've always got to help. And that's what Peter was saying to this man. Do you think that I did this? Do you think that we cured this man? We didn't do it. Wonder about that. The Lord did it. That's what he's saying to me. And then there's the question of the gift. In a way, that's the important thing here in this lesson. It's not the giver, the one that gave or the one that received, but it's the gift that's important. Peter gave the man something he didn't ask for. He asked for money. Peter said, "I haven't got any money." And of course, the way Peter said it, maybe you think he implied, that what he had was something of less value than money. "I haven't got any money but such as I have." He didn't mean that, of course. He meant, "I haven't any money, but I have something else that you need more than money, and that I will give to you." That's what he meant. Something he didn't ask for. Peter had something he couldn't keep. He just couldn't keep it. Money is only a symbol of value. What he gave was not inferior to money. Like the rich young ruler who came, you know, and he said, Christ said, "Sell all you have and give to the poor." I don't think he laid down the universal rule. Everybody's got to go out and sell everything. It wasn't that. But here was a man that valued money too much. And he's saying, and as proof of it, and Jesus said to him, "Sell all you have and give to the poor." He was disappointed and walked away because he had great possessions. Meaning not only that he had great possessions, but he had faith. He worshipped his possessions. That's the thing. And then Peter had something that would not cheat. Something couldn't be kept. He had to give it. some things can be preserved and pickled and kept for a good while. We have various ways now of preserving some food. But the most important things in life cannot be kept. Try to keep love, peace, and it'll degenerate into passivity. You can't keep those things. Try to keep money, and it changes into madness. Try to keep beauty, and you become a mummy. Try to keep vision, and you become visionary. Those are the valuable things in life, and if you try to keep them, they lose their whole value. He couldn't keep them. It's heaven alone that is given away. Only God that he had for the asset. Somebody said, "Earth hath no sorrow, but heaven cannot keep." I read this. What I'm going to say to you is not original with me, but I thought it was a pretty remarkable comparison that I got out of some kind of help that I read from. I'll just summarize it. The two very great, very significant events in the history of the world. Two very outstanding events. We're going to summarize, I bring it all down to two. One is the birth of Jesus. And the second was the atomic bomb. Let's see about those things. In some ways, they're very different, I must admit. In many ways, they're not common. One creates, the other destroyed. And yet, in looking at the comparison, the atomic bomb is a fact, not just a dream. It's pretty hard for us to realize at first, wasn't it? If you told anybody beforehand it was going to happen, they wouldn't believe it. Even Will Rogers sort of made fun back before he died. I see the split atom, the great disappointment to me. And everybody laughed about it. Who cares? Fact. We know now. It's a fact, not a dream. And Jesus is a fact. Not just somebody's notion. He happened. But the bomb happened. And then the bomb is a fact, not a fact by itself alone. Just the fact that there was a bomb, that wouldn't be very important. You must consider Hiroshima. It's the bomb plus what it did that made it important. And so with Jesus. It's not just that a perfect man lived, but what he did. Let's consider his life plus his liberation, the love, the power to set men free to be accomplished. Then there's another comparison to make. The bomb reveals the nature of existence as no other bomb or no other fact has ever revealed. We learn Einstein had sort of, in a way, predicted it by his first equation, E equals MC squared. There's some way all matter is reduced down to energy in this ultimate. The bomb proved it. We knew then the nature of existence, or the existence of nature, or what nature is, proved it. The nature of energy. Jesus was not just another man. After him, the whole universe is different. Just as the bomb showed us something about physical nature, Jesus showed us something about spiritual nature. And then the people who appreciate the bomb are those who experienced it, who saw it go off. You can't appreciate Jesus until you've seen him explode, so to speak, in the human life, as in the case of this beggar who went to Peter and John and received back his help. That is an important thing. He came to my door at midnight with a soul that was dark with grief. Give me a loaf of courage, a morsel of sweet relief. Drowsy-eyed and reluctant, I rose to unbar the door, ashamed to tell my neighbor how little I had in store. Such as I had, I gave him. A morsel of living bread. Out of that crumb of comfort, both he and I were fed. Lord, I prayed as I pondered, thou keeper of the store, forgive that I've asked so little. Give me more, that I may give more.